The coronavirus crisis continues to take its toll on the U.S. economy, which suffered its worst first quarter since the 2008 recession. That strain is being felt here in Massachusetts, which has been in its own recession since late last month. Just last week, a record nearly 250,000 people filed for unemployment. Many of them were gig workers who were eligible for those benefits for the first time. Here's Governor Baker talking about these new claims at a press conference yesterday.
So far, the system has seen well over 150,000 applications, and as of today, has paid out nearly $500 million in benefits to the people who've applied.
And as many businesses remain closed across the Commonwealth, things could actually get worse. So here with us to try to make sense of all of this is WBUR's Callum Borchers. Welcome back, Callum.
Hi there, Cal.
Hi. So paint the picture for us. How bad is it? What are we seeing here, Cal?
Well, I put it this way, Tiziana. I mean, the biggest hiring spree right now might be at the state's unemployment agency. You know, they typically have a team of 50 people to process unemployment claims, and they're over 1,200 workers now, Tiziana, doing this work. So they've added 1,000 people to process this unprecedented influx of jobless claims. To put it in perspective, you know, we've had almost 900,000 new unemployment claims since mid-March, which is just a staggering figure. And I think just to pull out one example that I find particularly disheartening. You know, last week the state called off in-person school for the rest of the academic year. And so the result of that was that we saw the biggest one-week increase in unemployment claims in the education sector last week. I mean, all these claims are sad in their way, but it's really disheartening when you see our educators being laid off.
That is really rough. We heard from the governor at the top that the state has paid out $500 million almost in benefits. And it's kind of even hard to get your mind around that. Have we ever seen anything like that before in the state? And what does that mean for our economy, our budget?
No, we haven't seen anything like it. And keep in mind, that $500 million the governor was talking about was just for this new crop of gig workers and self-employed workers who are applying for the first time. The total benefits paid, if you include the regular unemployment insurance, is $2.3 billion. So it's just an enormous number. And that 900,000 claims that we've seen since mid-March, that's more initial unemployment claims than we saw during the entire Great Recession. So this really is new territory here, and it's happened incredibly fast.
So these gig workers are included in the latest round of unemployment numbers. They came from the CARES Act, have not been eligible before. How does their presence in unemployment change things?
Well, I think, you know, it's a reflection that the gig economy is really part of the mainstream economy now, which I think is why you saw, as you mentioned, the CARES Act extending these benefits to those workers. And just to refresh people's memory, they're typically not eligible because they work outside of the system that funds the unemployment insurance that the rest of us would pay into with a regular sort of 9-to-5 job. And I think that what you saw was that they sort of weren't eligible to apply early in this coronavirus outbreak. And there was kind of this bottleneck. And so when the state said you can start applying last week, it really opened a floodgate. I mean, you had almost 170,000 of them apply last week. And that included musician Edrie Edrie from the band Walter Sickert and the Army of Broken Toys. She was among the first to apply, Tiziana. And she told me how she and her family had been getting by without benefits up until now.
We've been a little lucky in that some of the deposits for the shows that we were going to do, we were allowed to keep in hopes that we would be able to reschedule. We're also doing a nightly live stream and asking for tips and donations, and that has been actually putting food on the table.
So she'd been able to make it for a while there, Tiziana, but that's a hard way to go. And so since we spoke, Edrie has actually been approved for unemployment benefits. So she will start getting those very soon.
Well, that's good news. So this week we touched in on Radio Boston with a number of small businesses. We talked to John Hurst, Callum, who's the president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts. Here is what he had to say about the impact on businesses in the state.
These non-essentials that sell clothing or jewelry or furniture, they actually are either they're not selling anything, or frankly, they are ignoring the governor's order.
Business is your beat, Callum. How does that compare with what you're seeing?
Yeah, that's consistent with what I've heard as well. And of course, when John Hirst talks about those non-essentials, he's talking about the businesses that aren't on the sort of special list that the state has created that allows them to keep operating. You know, they're not grocery stores or they're not pharmacies. But I will say it's worth noting that it's not just those non-essential businesses that are hurting. You know, I spoke this week with Emily Cantor, who runs Cambridge Naturals. It's a specialty grocer with two small stores. So technically qualifies as an essential business. And yet, Tiziana, she's been keeping her stores closed because she says it's really hard to physical distance in a very small space like hers. And the result has been some really tough decisions.
We ended up furloughing about half of our team. And we were extremely fortunate to qualify and receive a PPP loan. And so we're in the process of actually bringing everyone back in waves. We're hoping to have essentially most of the team, if not all of the team, back by May 18th.
May 18th, of course, is the supposed expiration date, although we've seen it extended in the past, the expiration date on the non-essential business order. And the PPP she referred to there is the Federal Paycheck Protection Program, which forgives business loans if companies use three-quarters of the money to keep paying their workers. I will say, Tiziana, one other thing. I've heard from some businesses that are doing okay. For example, Karen Anderson at Anderson Bicycles in Quincy tells me that she's actually seeing a bicycle boom because people are just desperate to get outside and do something active.
So when we think about how fast things have declined for so many businesses and for the economy, Callum, how does that compare to past economic crises? You know, you've mentioned the Great Recession in 2008, post 9/11, et cetera.
Yeah, it really could be a terrible combination of the two, I'm sorry to say. You know, the suddenness of this decline, this cliff effect that we've seen, is probably more akin to what we saw after the 9/11 attacks, which was another sort of acute event, right, that drove a downturn in the same way that this outbreak has. But the duration of this downturn could more closely resemble that of the Great Recession, even though, you know, we may see some of these shuttered businesses resuming operations in the near future. I'm mindful that we recently saw that projection, Tiziana, from the Pioneer Institute, that Massachusetts is looking at 25% unemployment by June. Now, it's just a projection, but if we're anywhere close to that, that's a devastating figure when you think that we actually never got to double digits during the Great Recession. So even if this downturn technically ends in the near future and we go back on the upswing, we could be climbing out of a really deep hole, and that could take a while.
Oh, that is tough stuff. That's WBUR's Callum Borchers, who'll be hosting the next WBUR virtual town hall on Tuesday at 6 p.m. The topic will be the societal costs of COVID-19, and you can register and submit questions at wbur.org/events. Thanks, Callum.
Great to be with you, Tiziana.
So what do numbers like this mean for our state, and what do we need from government leadership in this kind of time? For some perspective, we're joined on the line by former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Governor.
Thank you very much.
So let me ask you, given your unique perspective, how are you thinking about this moment we're in, not only the economic impact, but just the sense of crisis in general?
Well, first of all, it is a crisis, and I thought that Callum's articulation that from a both fiscal and economic, it's a crisis like no other is really important to keep in mind, because there are lessons that can be drawn, but there's no equivalency. So let's be clear about that. I do think we are lucky that we have Governor Baker in charge, who not only has been in office for quite some time, but remember, had both experience, deep experience in healthcare, both in the private sector, but also previously in government as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but particularly for what's coming, also as a Secretary of Administration and Finance during a fiscal crisis, one that was maybe feels like a baby fiscal crisis now in the early 1990s. What I'm certain he knows and what I learned back from being a legislator then and was powerfully brought home to me after 9/11 is that time is not on your side.
You know, you just talked about Governor Baker praised his performance. I'm sure you're aware that the polling shows that governors are having a moment, especially in comparison to how people are feeling about the federal government's handling. How do you rate the job that Massachusetts is doing and the job that the federal government's been doing so far?
Well, I think, listen, everyone is not going to agree with what you do, but what people look for in a crisis is someone to make sense. out of what's happening to create a steady, well understood construct of what we're facing. And while there are many things that we do not know, I think that the public understands authenticity and honesty better. And they also, I think, is really, really important, are very much reassured when you don't know things by who you surround yourself with. And so relying on subject matter experts, pulling those people in to fill in some of the gaps, I think is what helps governors who are used to governing that way to be well respected in their response in making sense in a crisis. Having said that, you know, there are very, very difficult decisions ahead as governors have to figure out how to both make the necessary investments that will be required, but also make the changes, the restructuring, and frankly, yes, the cuts in spending, even if there is federal relief, that will be required to keep the state budget moving forward.
Governor Swift, a new report by UMass Boston's Donahue Institute finds that the state's been in a severe recession since the third week of March, worse than the 2008 recession, and the state economy shrank more significantly in the first quarter than the nation did. So what does that mean for the Commonwealth for the next quarter, for the next year, for the next couple of years?
So in Massachusetts, unlike some other states, we have a little bit of a glide path because income tax collections will lag income tax or income reductions, right? So because we're not as reliant on sales taxes, we'll feel most of this in fiscal year 21, which starts in July, not in this fiscal year 20. But the legislature and the governor are going to have to make historic restructurings and cuts. And I say restructurings because often when we think about these huge deficits in our budget, we only think about how do you reduce spending. That will clearly have to happen. And the longer you wait to reduce spending, the greater the programmatic impact. That's what I meant by time not being your friend. But also, I think, given the historic nature of what we're facing, the impact it's had on so many structures within our society, this is also a time to really rethink the models of how we deliver services and think very, very differently, particularly where we can rethink, restructure, and deliver services in a more efficient way, hopefully that doesn't too desperately impact employment.
And in our last, you know, 30 seconds or so, you governed through 9/11. It's a different crisis, but is there a leadership lesson you learned from that that you think really applies to today?
Yeah, make sure you get a lot of rest and surround yourself with subject matter experts. These decisions are not easy and they're not fun. I remember a particular person coming in and offering me the resignation who had served in my cabinet and had been a longtime friend. And he basically said, I was here to build, not to take apart, and I'm just not made for this.
Mm. That's former governor of Massachusetts, Jane Swift. I really appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
We don't have a cure or a clear treatment for COVID-19, but yesterday in an Oval Office update, we heard some promising news from Dr. Anthony Fauci, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease director.
The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery. This is really quite important.
Dr. Fauci acknowledged that the study into remdesivir hasn't yet reached statistical significance and more analysis does need to be done.
The reason why we're making the announcement now, whenever you have clear-cut evidence that a drug works, you have an ethical obligation to immediately let the people who are in the placebo group know so that they could have access. And all of the other trials that are taking place now have a new standard of care.
And there are hundreds of these other trials and studies underway worldwide. So we thought we'd like to get an overview of that research, both locally and globally. Joining to help us is Susan Slaugenhaupt. She's the scientific director of the Massachusetts Massachusetts General Research Institute and a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Susan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with this news. I'm glad to have you. Let's start with this news on remdesivir. How promising is what Dr. Fauci is outlining?
I think it's very promising. I was excited to hear the news. I think it gives us a place where we haven't been before, and that is a starting point with, you know, now that scientists understand that there is a drug that can block this virus, it gives us a place to look for better drugs, right? To optimize this particular drug and to, you know, continue to look for combination therapies that might be effective as we work to combat this virus.
So we are all hungry for this good news, hungry for hope that there's more help coming. But it does seem like we're getting these articles all the time, every day. Preliminary study results. This one claims this thing, this one another. But they're not peer reviewed. They're not finalized. Is there a danger in releasing results too soon and spreading confusion, especially given how hungry we are for them?
Yes. There is always, there definitely is a danger. And, you know, it's easy to tell the public to be a smart consumer of science. It's easy to say that, but it's difficult to do. It's difficult even for scientists to do that, to smartly consume science. The way the world works today, we see the results of new studies coming out. What seems like every minute, there's new data online, the results of studies. And we just have to remember, you know, how science is done and why it's so important to do thorough trials, to do careful research such that we get the right answer in the end, which is what we're all after.
And I do want to ask, you know, we heard Dr. Fauci at the top, and he did say that there's more to be done, but then he also referred to a new standard of care. So how can both of those things be true at the same time?
Well, I think it's as he said, when you do a trial and you find, you know, without, you know, you find that the treatment is working for some patients. And he said, we have an ethical obligation in order to, you know, unmask basically the trial and give patients who were getting placebo the drug, which means that, you know, that we have, that we have to give them this, the opportunity to have the drug. And so when I think it means a new standard of care, it will mean that when patients go to the hospital or need treatment for COVID-19, that this will be part of the treatment plan, if appropriate.
So let's dig into what's going on. Can you tell us about what research is being done at MGH? And like, is all the research focus in this area now?
You know, it's interesting. We have, you know, the Research Institute at Mass General is at the largest at any academic medical center. And we have research going on in all different areas. And it has been remarkable to watch people change what they're doing and rethink and innovate around the response to COVID-19. The Mass General Brigham has set up the Center for COVID Innovation, and there are four pillars under this center, one on devices, one on diagnostics, one on therapeutics, and one on data analytics. And if you think about that, what's been really interesting is if you think about just devices, some of the things you hear about in the news, okay, we need to do testing on everybody, but maybe we don't have enough nasal swabs in order to do that. And so we have people who are like, I have an idea. Let's invent a different type of nasal swab or a different type of way to decontaminate our personal protective equipment. And so people with all different talents and who work in all different areas of science have come together around these problems. And around each of these pillars, there have been calls where literally hundreds of people have joined to share their ideas and thoughts. And it's really been remarkable. The other thing I want to mention is just the amount of sharing of information and data that's gone on. So to watch people from across the institution and across the world really come together and share information and collaboration in such, it's so fast, has been unlike anything I've ever seen in my career.
That's really encouraging. I did notice in those four pillars, and I may just not be understanding, but I didn't hear anything that said prevention, you know, vaccination or what we do to keep people from getting the coronavirus in the first place.
Absolutely. I think that would fall. It does. It's a piece of the therapeutics. If you think about the way that there's a lot going on at the Ragon Institute, which is part of Mass General, our scientists are there working on developing vaccinations. And the other big thing, oh, go ahead, sir.
No, please finish your thought.
So the other big thing, I think, in terms of prevention is really understanding, you know, all of the epidemiology and the way this virus spreads. And what, as we return to our new normal, what type of things are we going to have to pay attention to so that we really understand how to keep ourselves safe as we go back out into the world?
Susan, what, you know, is there specific work, specific research that stands out to you right now as promising, maybe here in Boston or really anywhere around the world?
Yes, I think that, you know, there's some very interesting, so many interesting studies going on. What really strikes me that we really don't understand is why some people get so sick and why others don't. And so is that genetics? Is there underlying genetics? And I'm talking about some people have no underlying underlying symptoms, but they get so, so sick. And so there's some genetic studies, a worldwide consortium that's being led from by scientists at Mass General and the Broad Institute, but has really pulled together people from all over the world to begin to look at that. And then, you know, understanding the virus itself. How long does it live? How is it transmitted? You know, and what causes this acute reaction in the lungs to this virus? So I think, you know, studies into the absolute activity of this virus are super important. And then,
so you know,
other thing I wanted to comment on is about the people. So one of the things that's been really remarkable, I like to think of clinical research and research that we do at Mass General as a team sport, meaning, and I like to think of the patients not as research subjects, but as research partners. And people have been really willing to enroll in trials and to help us with our studies, because without the patients, we could do nothing that we need to do. And that's a very important concept.
You know, in popular conversation, we've heard about some specific areas of research or thought, like malaria drugs, plasma, UV light, disinfectants. Mm-hmm. Is there traction in research, real traction in research in any of those areas? Because they've been, you know, sort of batted around a lot.
Right. I think that there, you know, certainly in the antiviral drugs, like repurposing antiviral drugs and doing studies to try to determine if drugs that existing drugs might have some effect, or if they have a very minor effect, can we optimize them? Can we make them better? I'd say around light and UV light and other types of light, there is a lot of work that goes on in those areas in terms of using light to kill viruses and kill bacteria, et cetera. We have a center for the Wellman Center for Photomedicine at Mass General does a lot of work in this regard. So I would say nothing is off the table when we think about new ideas. I think scientists are some of the most creative and innovative people I know. And so I've watched many people who are doing work on one thing try to think about how they can apply it to COVID-19 with some really remarkable results.
I want to kind of stay on that general theme. You know, I mentioned that we both know that there's a lot of research being done, but also sometimes the message of the research can get muddled. You know, everybody knows about the questions President Trump asked last week about UV light disinfectants.
Right.
And it does raise a question about how researchers and members of the media like us make sure that the messaging is clear and that people understand what we do and don't know and what is and is not safe.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing you bring up, because one of the things that we focus on in my office in the Research Institute is thinking about how to best communicate about science. Science is sometimes a difficult thing when it comes to communication. Scientists use a lot of jargon. We use a lot of words that people don't recognize. And sometimes when we're trying to explain the work that we do, it gets lost in translation. And so we've done a lot of things around trying to teach our scientists to be better communicators. How do you talk about the science that you're doing in lay terms so that people really understand its importance? It's very, very critical, especially in times like this, when everyone is watching the evening news for their daily dose of science, which is great, but unless it's getting, unless it's told in a way that people can truly understand what it means, it's not going to help us.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's such a struggle. At the one hand, I'm excited to hear you say something like nothing's really off the table. And on the other hand, I wonder, Is that where we get the president muses about disinfectants and then we find out that there are people who are actually ingesting them thinking that maybe that's what we're
talking about? Right.
I actually think this is really hard.
Yeah, it is really, really hard because a lot of people misinterpret. I mean, just I'll think about one thing. Now we have a mask policy out there. And how many people in the last few days have you seen walking around with a mask below their nose? Yeah. I was in the grocery store the other day and I saw four people with masks below their nose, which means that we haven't even done a good job of communicating around the very fundamentals of why people are wearing a mask. And I think these other things, when we think about how drugs work and, you know, how we might kill the virus and other types of research, it's crucially important that we think long and hard about how to communicate it to the public so that people understand.
In our last half a minute or so, you know, what piece of research is most exciting to you or is giving you the biggest hope right now?
Well, I do think that these trials that are started, I mean, over the last, I could tell you at Mass General Brigham, we have 188 COVID-related studies that are starting, that are ongoing right now. And 6 weeks ago, there weren't any. And so the speed with which these things are getting up and running. And I think that, you know, I saw something the other day where someone said physician scientists have never been so important. And I completely agree with that. Having people who are taking care of these patients, but then also going to their labs and thinking about what they see in the clinic and going back to the lab is vital. And so I'd say the research in terms of, we know we're not going to keep people from getting sick until we have a vaccine. And we're not even sure that that will be 100% foolproof. So really the research into understanding how we can treat patients when they get sick and how we can shorten the time that they are in the hospital is really crucial.
That's Susan Slagenhaupt, the scientific director of the Mass General Research Institute and a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. I appreciate you joining us. Thanks.
Thank you.
Massachusetts had its largest day of fatalities from the coronavirus yesterday with 252 deaths. And overall, more than 3,400 people in Massachusetts have died. And that is a profound loss. While those numbers are gut-wrenching, they don't include people who have passed away from other causes. Every death leaves survivors who can't observe the rituals of burial and mourning in the way that we've come to expect and to need. So how do we mark the end of life now? It's a hard conversation, but we want to have it, and we want to have it with you. Have you lost someone? What are you doing to mark that loss or celebrate their life? Or are you afraid of losing someone now, given how disrupted our rituals have become? What other rituals have been disrupted for you that are just so important? Call us, talk with us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Daria Williams Fernandez joins us to have this conversation. Daria is president and director of the Floyd Williams Funeral Home in Dorchester. Welcome, Daria.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, honestly.
Also joining us is Arthur Francis Dulong III. He's the commission chairman at Pine Grove Cemetery in Lynn. Hello, Arthur.
Hello.
I really am so glad to have both of you. Daria, I'll start with you. We are hearing about funeral homes being overwhelmed by this crisis. How are you? How is your staff?
Well, honestly, I think it speaks well with that introduction as being overwhelmed. I think at this point in time, funeral homes are probably seeing something that they've never seen before. You know, you could have had maybe one or 10 funerals in a month, and now we're looking at 10 a day in reference to death calls. And it's just honestly heart-wrenching. You've been working in communities and seeing people and their families growing over the years, and then you just have this fail swoop of just a large group of individuals, whether young or old or middle-aged or whatever, and it's really honestly becoming, it is depressing. You know, we're human. I mean, I know we've been funeral directors and in funeral service forever, but I think if you lose the heart and the sensitivity, what are you? You know, what is life? So I think we feel this hit. We take it home with us. I think it's a fear for my staff on a daily basis on you know, how do I keep protecting them? I'm up on, you know, in the middle of the night looking up ways to get PPEs and things like that, because we're not able to get the resources that we need. So, yeah, it's definitely been a turn of events here.
That is gut-wrenching. Wow. Yeah. Arthur, I think everybody wonders in their head, God forbid they lose someone now. What does a burial look like? What about right now at Pine Grove Cemetery?
Well, with the virus the way it is, I mean, first and foremost, we have to protect our employees. But at the same time, you know, we're putting people, we're giving them their final resting spot. And a lot of people haven't had a chance to mourn or visit. So we're the final end, and then dictated by what's going on, we have to tell them that only a few family members can attend. And if it rains, we can't supply a tent. You know, we have to take back a lot of what we normally just gave to people, you know, in their time of need. And then we've gone from, you know, from 2-3 burials a week up to an average of 18. And of course, we're a very diversified city. You know, thank God we have a very young and free-thinking administration in here, because a lot of the rules change on the fly. You know, what is good and normal today could be changed tomorrow. You know, a lot of pressure on the employees that we have employed to, you know, inter people. And, you know, trying to keep them from being overwhelmed by it, by letting them know that, you know, they're representing an awful lot, but they're also there to comfort, you know, just by expression and just by being attentive. Each burial on a normal basis is different. You get rain, you got hilly material, you know, you have a lot of things that are involved. And now you're asking these men to do it 12 and 18 times a day. No, I'm sure it's stressful, but the city does well with PPE, constant reminders. And then, you know, we've got some very positive people, some good leadership. And,
good.
You know,
good.
And we're asking an awful lot from these men that do it on a day-to-day basis. But, you
Arthur,
know,
I want to.
Go ahead.
I want to jump in there because I want to invite listeners into this conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Whether you've lost a loved one and are having to go through the funeral rituals and other rituals of mourning differently, whether you're worried about that. And I'm actually going to take a liberty here and also invite you to show up for and give some support to Daria, to Arthur, to their teams, and to other people who might be listening, who are providing these services, who are giving support to families in grief and loss, and messages for them to keep them going too. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We do have our first caller on the line. I'd like to bring his voice in. This is Steve calling from Bridgewater.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because on March 25th, my father passed away.
I'm sorry.
And thank you. It was right at the beginning. It wasn't due to coronavirus, but the frustrating thing that happened was he was in hospice care, and I had my mother, my sisters, and I, we had 2 weeks where we weren't able to visit him because of the virus and not being able to be allowed into the nursing home. So we had, like, before he died, we had, like, 2 weeks where we weren't with him. Mm-hmm. One thing that happened recently is that, like, 2 days ago, my cat died as well.
And oh, what gosh, ended up Steve.
It's been a rough month.
Right.
But first with my father, we weren't able to have a funeral. Like, it was just my mother, my sisters, and I at the National Cemetery, 50 yards away from just watching the casket go down. And that's all we could do. We couldn't even see each other in each other's cars. We had to stay in our own cars. what ended up happening, tying in with my cat dying 2 days ago, my daughter, who's 9 years old, she broke down after our cat died, and she felt guilty because she was sadder about my cat dying because she didn't have a chance to see my father at his funeral, so she didn't have closure where we had closure with our cat.
Right.
So it
right.
was more immediate for her because she could see the cat than it was with her grandfather.
Yes, and she was able to, we were able to have like a little, we had a family ceremony for the cat, and it really kind of touched her, and that night she broke down crying, saying, like, I feel bad because I didn't act the same way when my grandfather died.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Steve, thank you so much for your call. And
thanks. And
my heart really is with you for all that loss. That's a lot. And Daria, what do you think when you hear a story like Steve's?
Well, it's honestly something that's ringing true for a lot of people right now. I think, you know, every funeral home is making their own decisions about, you know, the parameters that are already on the table, but then additionally how maybe they're over doing additional things, or maybe they're cutting out services altogether. We are trying to still keep services going, but staying with 10 people and having 2 people rotations and things like that. There's different ways of trying to do it. It's way out of the box. A lot of the times when we're talking about the traditional way of doing funeral services. I think that, you know, my condolences go out to him, obviously, for the loss of his dad. I think when he talked about prior to the time of passing, not having the days and the time to actually be with their loved one, that is something that I'm hearing every day because, you know, we're losing a lot of people within nursing homes, and those nursing homes are closing people from outside, you know, to coming in to even visiting their loved ones. And so at the beginning of this, I saw a lot of people with dementia that we were losing because they didn't have any walking connection to a family member that kind of maybe kept them in the present. And so, you know, and as time's going on, I'm hearing more and more people of just depression in itself. I think we have to honestly understand that we were already just recognizing mental health issues, whether they were there or not before. And I think we are definitely in a situation where if we are not addressing mental health, in whether it's the effects that of this, or definitely the, you know, this overlaying some issues that were underlying before.
The governor had a press conference today, and at it, Secretary of Health and Human Services Mary Lou Sutters talked about the fact that next month, beginning tomorrow, is Mental Health Month, and how important it is right now that we turn our attention to, you know, mental health and mental well-being. Daria, I'd love to get another call in here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation with your own experiences with shouts of support to people who are helping with the process of death and dying, call us and be a part of this conversation. Sharon is on the line from Cambridge. Sharon, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I feel like I'm not going to get the words out right, but I had a family member.
There's no right way, Sharon. It'll be okay.
my aunt died earlier this month, and it wasn't from COVID, but it's out of state. And I feel like my family, everyone's been deprived of the rituals of mourning. I can't go to the funeral. There's no, we're Jewish. There's not going to be the ritual washing of the body, and there's not going to be the Shiva and the funeral and all of that just isn't happening. I don't know when we're going to see her. And then this week, my husband's friend, his 40th birthday is next month. He died in New York. And again, another funeral that I can't go to. And I don't think that either of them were particularly religious, but I feel for their families. I hate that people aren't getting the funeral is a part of it. It's recognized. Like, there's so much death that people aren't being individually recognized. And everybody's missing out. Like, they deserve it. And we need to be around people to have our own closure and mourning. And I'm just sad. And
I'm sorry, Sharon. I'm so glad you called and shared that with us. Let us at least carry that sadness with you. Arthur, I know when you talked to our producer, Zoe, you talked a lot about the great care that people are taking with the deceased and that you wanted people to know and understand that. And maybe that would give Sharon some comfort, especially given what we just heard from her.
Yeah, you know, we all know we're almost past due. Yeah, you're only going to be around for a certain amount of years. So the burial, you know, the rural burial, when it started back in the 1830s, was to make it a park, make it a place to contemplate, to walk, and then to realize that you're passing on a loved one, and this will go on generation after generation. When I leave, somebody follows behind me. But we give the trust that we will always take care of your loved one. When you're not here, there will be somebody taking care of your loved one and maybe you in perpetuity. And this is something we take a lot of pride in. You know, we're only here for a short time, but the commission, the city, you know, and even the country itself realize that, you know, it's a foregone conclusion you are going to, you know, eventually die. But the trust in the knowledge that you will be taken care of, even, you know, until the very end. I mean, it's an amazing thing, the care of the flowers, how we cut the grass, how we maintain a sense of dignity, beauty, and a place where you can either celebrate or mourn your loved ones. But we know we're the end of the line as far as life goes. So,
Arthur, thank you for that. Yeah, I think that's so important. And before I let Sharon go, Daria, are you seeing other rituals that people are coming up with for themselves, for their families, that maybe can give Sharon some comfort and something else that she can do when she can't be present in the ways she would want to for the people that she loves?
Yeah, definitely. It's been one of those things that I've been strategizing for families. It's giving a platform. You know, we've always had just honestly the ease of just having a place and that place being a place where people could wake and additionally have services. But it's got to be more than that now. It's got to be a platform where we are creating some place where people can memorialize in a different realm. And so whether it be somebody's website and on that funeral home's website, you have make sure the obituary of that life goes up there. Make sure that their picture goes up there. Maybe not spending the expense of necessarily putting anything out in a newspaper, but maybe even using the social media aspects of things. Doing a memorial video. Like my website, we have a memorial video that you can go up and with music that you can attach to it, favorite songs and things like that. And then also, if there's an opportunity to go to graveside, you know, go to graveside. And if the funeral home provides a live stream, let them live stream right there around graveside. So you can feel, you know, and people are doing the responses online and things like that. I think one thing about it is, I think as funeral directors, we know that getting that opportunity to visually see and touch your loved one maybe one last time is important to some people. That's what we look at as the first step in really starting the grieving process, because the thing is, it becomes real on that day. And some people could, you know, when we're talking about mental health, stay in denial, stay in all of the different levels of grief. And so it's one of those things where, just like she says, the closure and not being getting that opportunity, this little one recognizes the difference. You know, it's clear that our society was not, you know, possibly took it for granted that we did these things. You know, it was traditional and we just did them and we did them and we did them. And now we're forcing ourselves to have to think of ways of still giving that, whether you look at a day of a memorial. Sometimes people are forced to cremation, taking those cremains and burying, getting together later on when this is calmed down a little bit and, you know, burying those cremains in a cemetery, or additionally putting them in a niche and having a small cemetery.
Go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead and finish your thought, and then I want to check back in with Sharon, but please go ahead and finish your thought.
Ceremony or something like that, and same thing around graveside. So, yeah, I definitely understand her feelings at this point in time.
So, Sharon, I just want to check back in with you. I'm hoping some of that might be helpful for you in just understanding how well your loved ones are being cared for now, and that there might be opportunity in the future to have some of the rituals you haven't had now.
Yeah, somebody actually did make a Facebook private group to memorialize him, and people are posting photos and sharing stories, and that actually has been helpful. Mm-hmm. It's hard when, I mean, I was friend, but I wasn't super close, and so I feel like I'm in it, but not, you know, yeah. In that inner circle. So I just, it's hard to know how things are going to go in the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hope
well, Sharon,
there'll be
listen.
A memorial that I can go to.
I hope so too. And again, our thoughts are with you. I'm glad that you called in, and I, you know, I wish you good care as you go through this grieving. Daria and Arthur, I want to come to, it's hard to switch to some practical pieces of conversation, but there are a couple of things I want to ask you in our remaining time. You both have talked about the practicalities of protecting workers. And Daria, you referenced, you know, looking for protective equipment at night. Do you both feel that you have the materials and the equipment that you need for your teams to do their jobs? Arthur, I guess I'll ask you first, and then Daria, I'll come to you.
For sure.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the powers that be, you know, you have, you know, the people in charge, Democrat Andy Hall, Lisa Nerick. Oh, yes, we asked for, and they supplied. You know, like I said, changing the rules on the fly is a pretty hard thing to do. To turn, you know, we were focused on beautifying, developing, and now to being overwhelmed with burials. You know, a complete, you know, 180 and focused on it. But yes, they've been, you know, they've been great. We're not denied
Good.
Anything, even when it comes Good. To, you know, bringing people in and having them talk. Oh, yeah, I'm more than satisfied. I'm very proud
and
of
Daria?
The way that they reacted.
I'm glad. And again, I'm sorry for both of you if I'm interrupting you. It's a little hard from a distance, and I have to manage to our clock, too. Daria, in our last half a minute or so, how about you? Do you have the materials you need?
No, I think that it's a little bit different. I think when you're in the private sector of things, our distributors are kind of cut off by the federal government at this point in time. And so our ability to get these items have been actually quite difficult. So unfortunately not having the same response. I've, you know, reached out to the different organizations. I've received some from the National Guard dropped off, unfortunately, for a funeral home to function in its normal practice. Those items would not suffice. So that is becoming quite the issue, I think, across the board. And unfortunately, we're seeing some effects of that over time.
Well, Daria Williams-Fernandez of the Floyd Williams Funeral Home and Arthur Francis Dulong III at Pine Grove Cemetery in Lynn, I want to thank you both. Thanks for being with us.